Hi, and welcome to Kapwood Radio. I'm Martin Jansen. This feature podcast is not dealing with Donald Trump, Brexit, global migration, inequality, corruption, automation, or climate change. Instead, Len Martin presents a fresh construct written by Graham Ferguson. It offers a new language to better understand the practical workings of banks that create our finances and the problems that have plagued our planet for far too long. Welcome to this radio feature.
Do banks actually lend money? What is implied if they don't? By Graham Ferguson. By abandoning present banking terminology in favour of a less colourful, simpler, more basic language, we can uncover a hitherto obscured view of our monetary system. Perhaps it gives a clearer concept of why our world walks the tight-stretched budgetary tightrope between profit and loss, where commerce forever teeters on the brink of a financial imbalance of payments. It's reliant on the spin of a quick, slick, balanced budget to give some slight semblance of a stability that isn't there, was never there. A new voice may offer a new way of thinking and a more accurate alternative perspective from which to relate to the economy that surrounds, supports, and at the same time oppresses us all. This talk describes the business of banking in more accurate and less emotive terms than those used in previous talks. Let's forego such terms as low or high interest rates, loans, bank rates, mortgages and bankruptcies, etc. The received language of modern banking could be, by design, misleadingly oblique, lacking optional expressions of financially beneficial, hence social possibilities. In a more literal definition, the basic transactional functions of banking procedure can be reduced rather severely to a few simple terms, indeed just two simple terms. Banks buy cheap, banks sell dear. They buy property cheap from a vendor and sell it to you, their client, for profit. In this new speak, they are not actually lending money. They are not actually loaning you anything. They are selling you something. Now, how is that for a new way of looking at it? The bank, using their own money, pays for and buys from the vendor that item you are unable to pay for in a lump sum, provided you have first contractually agreed to buy that item from the bank. After lodging a deposit with your bank and, over a set period, paying installments at an inflated price, you pay for it from your income. The traditional language says you are paying off a loan. But you're not. The bank pays the original vendor for the item. It then legally belongs to the bank. They have and hold the deeds, the receipts. They own it. If a bank or any other business owns property, would you call it a security? At that juncture, the real monetary transaction has been between the bank and the vendor. The following transaction is between the bank and you, as the contracted buyer, paying with your money from your income. Traditionally, you are paying off a mortgage loan. The bank's client, you the bank's client, in handing over the bank checks to the vendor, is merely acting as a go-between. The bank is doing the buying, paying with their money. The bank client was in no financial position to pay the vendor, except in the rare instance of vendor's terms. However, in one sense, the bank has taken on that role and become a vendor, providing the vendor's terms that enable their client to buy it from them. There is no money lent or borrowed. There is no money on loan, so no debt incurred. Just a straightforward purchase and sale of property by a bank with the proviso that you, their client, buy it from them on time payment with your money from your income. Can you rationally imagine a bank or any business loaning you the money to purchase something from them? in paying off something from Harvey Norman, has dear old Harvey lent any money? Has any money been borrowed from him? All the money that circulates in the global economy is the money from a bank purchase. When a bank buys a product, the purpose is to sell and make profit from the client already contracted to buy that product from the bank. The bank's purchase money increases the general money pool. When the client buys the product from the bank, that money comes back out of circulation to pay the bank. But keep this in mind, the bank wants and must have more money back than they paid, just as with the yield of the bonds they buy. They buy the bond knowing the yield will be profit. Why else buy them? The bank's markup, their profit, is extra money that must come back out of circulation. Banks' purchases provide all the money in circulation, and that's the reason why all commercial profits must grow to fill the gap between the initial cost and the profit that must be made. All commerce, national, government, private or individual, must continually reduce spending and increase income to save enough to pay the extra. In this mostly self-defeating finance-scarce economy, the level of competitive intensity must be as immense as the stress levels it causes. To recap, with that house you want, the bank, with its money, will buy the property on a contractual agreement that you, the client, buy it from the bank, with your own money, over time, and at the bank's price. The bank pays the vendor. It's bought the property with its money, not the client, who has no money. So the property is the bank's, and it has not really loaned you any money. Instead, they've put the purchase money in circulation by paying the vendor. If the client reneges on the contract to buy it, the bank will sell the property to someone else. If you buy anything on an installment system, you are not borrowing money, you are paying for the item. You are buying it on time payment, out of your income. You have not borrowed your income. You buy the property from the bank using an installment payment plan. It would be utterly silly to assume a buyer is borrowing the money when instead they must pay the bank a suitable deposit. Does the bank loan you the money for your deposit with them? The item itself, if the purchaser is using it, is not borrowed or on loan either. You, the client, are in the process of buying it and are allowed to use, maintain, and insure it, if that's as agreed. This is a banking business model that sells a good to a bank client at a profit, as would any other merchant. The average merchant trader, however, buys with no actual guarantee of a sale. The main difference here is that banks buy their merchandise after the buyer has committed to buy it from them. Is this the real meaning of their term, security? If some unforeseen contingency arises where the client is unable to finish the purchase payments, the bank will sell the item to another client or to any buyer. It can sell to whoever if the first sale falls through. Certainly, the bank strives to turn over as many sales by signing up as many buyers as it can, but prudently. This is limited to the speed with which the world of commerce can achieve profit growth. As a business, this is how a bank must proceed. If you need money in hand, the bank may agree to buy a worthwhile security from you after first contracting you to buy it back from them for more than they paid you, as in a mortgage transaction. The money the bank pays you, the payment you receive from the bank for your property, puts money in your hands. It has not been borrowed from a bank, but to get the property back, you will have to buy it. Guess who from and what with. So the money in circulation results from a bank purchase that puts it in there. It's the business transaction that is antecedent to all other commercial transactions and determines the health of our economy. Another insight revealed by the new language is that banks are not solely controlled by their boards of directors or their CEOs or bank managers. The rule of profit, growth or die determines the operations of the banking industry. A computer pre-programmed to work successfully to that one rule could, and probably will soon, do it better and faster in our rapidly encroaching world of automation. What controls the global economy's economic enterprise is that rule of profit growth to which a bank must also adhere or go bankrupt. From this new angle, we see that our banking industry and its economy marches to a distant drum, not to the conventional reasons we've had drummed into us for generations. But what use can this revised economic understanding be to us, the sorely oppressed? Well, there's maybe a psychological advantage in dropping the old descriptive spin of finance and economic jargon of the whole banking process. Debt, for instance, when we haven't borrowed any money. The loan repayments we are saddled with are really time payments for whatever it is we are buying from a bank. Feeling beholden to banks when it's they who need, for their own solvency, to sell us a product. Perhaps an enlightened feeling could replace the in-debt feeling of indebtedness. A benefit could be feeling better informed, more in charge of our situation by having a clearer comprehension of the banking process that oppresses. Knowing that we are wrong when we are imagining that we're always in debt to a bank, instead of just buying property from an anxious-to-sell bank. Profit pays overhead costs, wages, and shareholders' dividends, and that profit comes from sales. If we reassess our situation using the new concept, that stress can fall away. We can instead see it as the way we buy, using our own money from our own income. Do we really imagine we can borrow the money to buy property from a bank? Remember, we are not buying from the original vendor. We become aware that bank dominance has left all other global businesses, both private and government, financially subservient to it. Without that financial input when a bank buys, there would be no money, and the commercial world as we know it would not be, could not be. Our new terminology shows clearly that with the seemingly innocuous monetary rule of profit growth, we've unwittingly produced a world in constant social turmoil and conflict. But perhaps the best value stemming from the new terminology is the insight from the clearer picture it presents. We realise from it that the rule of profit growth has produced an oligopoly, the like of which our world has never before experienced. It has resulted in a total corporate control of global enterprises by the bank industry. But even though there is no legal precedent, there may still exist a legal pathway to redress the dictates of this gigantically powerful profit growth rule. We can be aware that there can never be enough available funding in circulation to bring about a sustainable, socially secure, and cooperative, therefore civilized world. We must contest and compete for that so scarce commodity of finance. So, in the short-term scenario, more money than the community has in it is needed to cover the sum of our installment payments. More bank spending is always required to finalize a purchase. But in the long term, financial scarcity is a never-ending, cyclic, unresolvable economic problem, especially as finance, though deficient, provides our only access to goods and services. But it's not the banks at fault. They must abide by the rule. It's the rule itself that reigns supreme over our world economy. Like a seemingly invincible global authority, a colossus supremo, the obnoxious, exploitive, profit growth rule demands for our short-term financial survival total adherence to its principle of total obedience. But here's the rub. The rule is only a logically rational survival response to the way we put money into circulation. This rule does not do long-term. The rule of profit first pays no heed to the moral, ethical, or physical aspirations of humanity or our human environment. These are all secondary elements to profit, there to be exploited if need be, to guarantee the growth of profit. It's easy to see that the rule has everything to do with our competitive human behavior, corruption, exploitation, and our all-destructive, climate-changing human activity. It is the breeding ground for cutthroat, exploitive, and all too often corrupt business and political practices. The massive controlling power of the rule is now firmly embedded in our collective psyche. Most of us forever battle and scrabble in a finance-scarce, combative economic environment because profit growth must be made just to keep our economy viable. It demands our full attention and leaves us little time to reason why. The average human lifespan is fully occupied in competing for our financial survival, with little opportunity to ponder causation. Conventional banking terminology obfuscates the real nature of their business practice. But like any other business, they do this because they just want to survive. But our present witless society is the result. We just live playing out the effects of an intentionally misleading word set of dishonest terms stemming from a destructive rule that must be obeyed to the letter. And the profit growth rule stems from the method we use to get money into circulation. Hopefully some future generation will evolve, exhibiting enough wit to grasp the absurdity of the situation and just rectify it. However, with little or no evidence in support of this hope, it may just remain our little wishful thought.
Thank you for listening. We hope this has sparked your interest and led to a better understanding of the global finances that determine our economies and influence social and cultural values. I'm Martin Jensen, the producer, and I'd like to thank Graham Ferguson for this article and Len Martin for his quality presentation. If you like this podcast or have questions, feel free to comment and download more free Kaput Radio features. Just search for Kaput X Radio, Kaput with double T and the letter X and radio. You will find my podcast directory listing over 337 other podcasts for free download. Enjoy and catch me again with more Kaput Radio features.